one in practice. I have a constant debate with my father, Kosoy said, who thinks the single most evil human being in the history of the planet was Ronald Reagan, because he single-handedly convinced us, as a society, the government's bad. He added, if you think about Bill Clinton's success in the 90s, his third way was all about basically adopting a lot of that language, and so no one's really told us government is a good thing for a very long time. Saying this seemed to make Kosoy reflect on whether he had unwittingly become the latest link in this chain of liberals consolidating the war on government by proffering private solutions to public problems. Now I'm not going to get a good night's sleep as I think about this, he said. Whatever Kosoy's private doubts, B Corps were championed all over Market World. The Aspen Institute had named not only Kosoy, but all three co-founders of B Lab as Henry Crown Fellows. The Ford Foundation had given B Lab a grant. The founders were regularly praised by recognized thought leaders and often heard themselves called the same. Two of the three of them had given a TED Talk. B Corps certified by Kosoy's team were among the most admired companies at Summit at Sea. Their system for rating companies had been discussed at Davos. The Beck Center for Social Impact and Innovation at Georgetown promoted B Lab's fellowship to train people on using business as a force for good. A leading B Corp called Laureate Education had attracted George Soros and KKR as investors and named Bill Clinton its honorary chancellor, a job that paid nearly $18 million over 5 years, according to the Washington Post. You ought to look at these B corporations, Clinton has said, and he elevated B Lab by featuring them 1 year on the main stage of CGI. Kosoy wondered how much he and B Lab would have to change to pursue reform of the system itself, to get into that terrain of making bad harder. For starters, B Lab had a strict ethic of positivity. We stand for something, not against anything, was one of its mantras. But real change can require being against things, and he knew that. Real change often demands sacrifice, and these days, Kosoy said, not that many people are really putting themselves at risk. Real change may compel trade-offs and the necessity of choosing your priorities. I don't believe that everybody just trying to be more responsible leads to higher returns, he said. There are trade-offs, he added, but no one wants to tell that story. He sometimes looked at the little Market World initiatives all around him that pursued change and avoided real change at the same time, and he wondered if it wasn't just a way of throwing scraps to keep the peace. When private equity firms quoted William Blake and spoke of changing the world, how genuine was it, and how much was it a bid, as Kosoy put it, to make people feel like they've been heard and not have bloody revolution? Kosoy still believed deeply in what he and B Lab were doing. But he asked himself questions like, at what point is it the right moment to say, great, this is how all business must act? He said, as big as what I think we're doing is, that would be taking a fundamental shot into the heart of capitalism. Some bright burning force within Kosoy seemed to want to take that shot, to challenge the people he once worked with in finance, to change business for all so that everyone played by the same rules, to go after the worst first rather than make it easier for the already good to be good, to change the system with the consent of its citizens, not just work around its decay. And yet that force could feel itself to be up against a hugely powerful and pervasive web of myths. Market World. If the force throbbing within Kosoy, if change itself, genuine from the root change, was to have a shot, many people would need to be freed of these myths and remember what change actually is. On the night when Kosoy sat wondering about his way of changing the world, his alma mater, Stanford, was hosting an event across the city that might have cost him even more sleep had he attended it. It was a panel discussion about a collection of essays titled Philanthropy in Democratic Societies, featuring two of its editors and two others representing the giving world. The host for the event was David Siegel, a philanthropist who had reportedly made $500 million in a single year and who had opened the offices of his hedge fund, Two Sigma, to host the event, despite the book's rather critical take on philanthropists. The people who came, some to hear big philanthropy get its comeuppance, first gathered in the hedge fund's airy kitchen, nibbling on miniature tacos the girth of a finger and sipping wine. Then the program began, and before long, Chiara Cordelli, an Italian political philosopher at the University of Chicago, who had co-edited the collection and contributed an essay, found herself sitting two panel seats over from a philanthropist who embodied everything she challenged in her scholarly writings. He was Sanford Weill, a former chairman and chief executive of Citigroup, and now an active donor whose name adorned a wide array of causes. Weill was the anti-Kassoy, a product of the system who had few doubts about it, who believed as fiercely as a person could believe in the importance of elite private saviors like him. Weill hadn't been big on government doing things when he was building Citigroup and wanted to be free of regulation, and now he wasn't big on government doing things when it came to solving public problems. He thought, then and now, that problems were best left to people like Sanford Weill. That evening, Weill repeatedly said rich people like him had to step in and solve public problems because government was too broke, too incapable, wasn't up to the task. He said this even though he personally was one of the reasons the government from time to time lacked for resources. Weill had, after all, been named by Time one of the 25 people to blame for the financial crisis, because of his relentless push for a vision of banks as all things to all customers, and his persistent lobbying, ultimately successful, for the repeal of Glass-Steagall, a law dating back to the Great Depression that restricted investors' risk-taking. He had advocated for too-big-to-fail banks, and he had gotten his way, which had helped to bring about the largest financial crisis in decades, which had caused the government to spend tens of billions of dollars bailing Citi out. And now, Sanford Weill bemoaned that the government had no money, and thus he had to chip in and help out. By the third or fourth time Weill said this, Cordelli had grown irritated enough to shoot back a reply. "The government is us." Weill was unmoved by this, and seemed immovable. Yet Cordelli's vision of what is really going on when elites try to change the world may be the bracing tonic that Kassoy and other market worlders harboring doubts need to see their situations more clearly and perhaps alter their ways. More important, it may give the rest of us a sense of permission to seek a better world with or without their help. The morning after the panel, Cordelli sat in a quiet, high-ceilinged room in the Soho Grand Hotel, on a high-backed sofa in front of an unmanned DJ booth. She nursed coffee in a paper cup, and speaking in careful, methodical sentences, sought to unravel some of Market World's self-justifications. Take, for instance, the view that Market World has a duty and right to address public problems, and indeed to take a lead in developing private solutions to them. This, for Cordelli, was like putting the accused in charge of the court system. "The question that elites refuse to ask," she said, "is, why are there in the world so many people that you need to help in the first place? You should ask yourself, have your actions contributed at all to that? Have you caused, through your actions, any harm? And if yes, the fact that now you are helping some people, however effectively, doesn't seem to be enough to compensate." Cordelli was speaking of both the active committers of harm and the passive permitters of it. The committers are what she calls the easy cases. She said, "If you have campaigned against inheritance tax, if you have directly tried to avoid paying taxes, if you supported and directly, voluntarily benefited from a system where there were low labor regulations and increased precarity, then," she argues, "you have directly contributed to a structure that foreseeably and avoidably harmed people. That is direct complicity. As for the people who don't help run Goldman Sachs or Purdue Pharma, who live decent lives and attempt to make the world slightly better through the market, Cordelli called them the harder cases. An economist might say the marginal contribution to the world made by someone like Kassoy was positive. Cordelli rejected this analysis. She saw in each of these types of efforts not a single moral act, but two. Alongside the act of helping was a parallel act of acceptance. These market worlders, with their myriad private initiatives, were doing more than merely adding good to the world. They had benefited in the past, and often continued to benefit, from a system, a set of institutions and laws and norms that dependably blocked many people from living full lives, and that had in the United States in recent decades increased rather than shrunk the ranks of those who had been shut out. These elites were, she said, like the owner of a painting who later finds out it had been stolen. Even if the theft was before the purchase, Cordelli said, still, It seems that if you know the person the painting has been stolen from, you have an obligation to return it to them. Maybe even to apologize, acknowledging that you have an object that is not your own. Acknowledging that you have something that has been the fruit of that injustice. As in Kasoy's case, the choice to solve a problem in one way is a choice not to solve it in another way. Had Kasoy pursued his thought of making it harder for companies to do bad things, involving himself with politics and the law and the system itself, success might have meant the loss of opportunity for the Kasoys of the future, and could even have come at a cost to his own earnings from his old life. That was no easy decision to make. But that is a choice, Cordelli tells us. To do a modest bit of good while doing nothing about the larger system is to keep the painting. You are chewing on the fruit of an injustice. You may be working on a prison education program, but you are choosing not to prioritize the pursuit of wage and labor laws that would make people's lives more stable and perhaps keep some of them out of jail. You may be sponsoring a loan forgiveness initiative for law school students, but you are choosing not to prioritize seeking a tax code that would take more from you and cut their debts. Your management consulting firm may be writing reports about unlocking trillions of dollars worth of women's potential, but it is choosing not to advise its clients to stop lobbying against the social programs that have been shown in other societies to help women achieve the equality fantasized about in consultants' reports. Economistic reasoning dominates our age, and we may be tempted to focus on the first half of each of the above sentences, a marginal contribution you can see and touch, and to ignore the second half, involving a vaguer thing called complicity. But Cordelli was challenging elites to view what they allow to be done in their name, what they refuse to resist, as being as much of a moral action as the initiatives they actively promote. Her argument is not that every bad thing that happens in the world is your fault if you fail to stop it. Her claim, rather, is that citizens of a democracy are collectively responsible for what their society foreseeably and persistently allows, that they have a special duty toward those it systematically fails, and that this burden falls most heavily on those most amply rewarded by the same, ultimately arbitrary set of arrangements. If you are an elite who has campaigned for or supported the right policies, well, let's suppose that you are not causally complicit in any direct sense, she said. Still, it seems to me that you might owe a responsibility or duty to return to others what they have been unfairly deprived of by your common institutions. The winners bear responsibility for the state of those institutions and for the effects they have on others' lives, for two reasons, Cordelli said. Because you're worth nothing without society, and also because we would all be dominated by others without political institutions that protect our rights. To take each of those in turn, she says you are worth nothing without society because there can be no hedge fund managers, nor violinists, nor technology entrepreneurs in the absence of a civilizational infrastructure that we take for granted. Your life, your talents, what you do could not be possible if they weren't for common institutions, Cordelli says. If the streets weren't safe or the stock markets weren't regulated, it would be harder to make use of one's talents. If banks weren't forced to offer a guarantee of guarding your money, making money would be pointless. Even if your children attended private school, public schools very likely trained some of their teachers, and publicly financed roads connected that island of a school to the grid of the society. Then there is the fact that, absent a political system of shared institutions, anyone could dominate anyone. Every person with anything precious to protect would be at constant risk of plunder by everybody else. To live in a society without laws and shared institutions that applied equally to all would be, Cordelli says, to live dependent on the arbitrary will of another. It would be like a form of servitude. Think of the person who seeks to change the world by doing what can be done within a bad system, but who is relatively silent about that system. Think of the person who runs an impact investing fund aimed at helping the poor, but is unwilling to make the connection, in his own head or out loud, between poverty and the business practices of the financiers on his advisory board. Think of 100 variations of this example. Such a person, for Cordelli, is putting himself in the difficult moral position of the kind-hearted slave master. For me, it is equivalent to have a master who denies people the right to freedom, and then, however, justifies that by saying, "I'm a benevolent master," she said. "So I actually support slavery, but once I have the slave, I really treat them well, and actually they live under great conditions." One can counter that if you have slavery, of course, it's better to be a benevolent master than a non-benevolent master. "That seems to be obvious," Cordelli said. "Yet when it comes to looking back on a system like slavery, most people would agree that the only reasonable course of action back then would have been to refuse to buy a slave, refuse to participate in slavery, refuse to go along. It is when considering the present that things get murkier. A political and economic system that has shut half the nation out of growth and progress for a generation becomes understandable, becomes something to work around. The issue is said to be complicated. While some fear their stance will come to seem unreasonable one day, they choose acceptance. They seek to work through and with the culprits of injustice. They might even enlist them to advise or sit on the board of their justice-seeking project. Sometimes that acceptance masks itself as incompetence or ignorance. Yes, someone like Laurie Tisch might say, in theory the system must be changed, but it is so hard. Structural changes and systemic changes are fine and good, Amy Cuddy says. The problem she confronts is, who do you talk to make that happen? Creating a voluntary pool of better-behaved capitalism on the side is easy, Andrew Kosoy says. Changing the law for all businesses requires an activist's gifts, which he claims to lack, and honorable office holders at all levels of politics, a profession that doesn't offer the lucrative rewards of market world. Cordelli dismisses this fatalism about the system, this emotion of impotence regarding institutional change, as absurd. It is absurd, she says, because citizens of market world live their life through a sense of themselves as entrepreneurs, as agents of change. But this gung-ho attitude about bending the world to their will turns out to be rather temperamental. When it comes to effecting change in a way that makes them feel good, when it comes to building a business, lobbying for certain things, effectively helping some people through philanthropy, then they are agents, Cordelli said. They powerfully and intentionally can exercise change. However, she went on, when it comes to paying more taxes, when it comes to trying to advocate for more just institutions, when it comes to actually trying to prevent injustices that are systemic or trying to advocate for less inequality and more redistribution, then they're paralyzed. There's nothing they can do. This is absurd in the sense that it's a concept of agency that doesn't make sense philosophically and doesn't make sense practically, she said. It is, first of all, not necessarily any harder to fight for a change in corporate law than to invent a parallel infrastructure of capitalism. It is not necessarily harder to seek more effective taxation of globe-trotting plutocrats than to develop an elaborate annual conference getting them to give a little back. The market worlders, Cordelli is reminding us, are selling themselves short. They do big, complex, elaborate things all the time. They solve hard problems. Their declared inability to contribute to solutions at the political and systemic level can ring hollow. Besides, the system under which market world has thrived in recent decades was not a naturally occurring phenomenon. It was engineered by man. Market world had shown itself willing and able to engage in the arena of politics, to change the system when it came to seeking lower taxes, freer trade, the repeal of laws like Glass-Steagall, debt reduction, scaled-back regulation, and many other policies that have made the present age so bountiful for its own citizens. Yet the reversal of some of the very things it had fought for was deemed too hard, too political, too vast to take on. As harsh as her criticisms might sound to them, Cordelli is giving Kosoy and others in market world a way out. She is confessing, on their behalf, what some of them privately fear to be true, that they are debtors who need society's mercy, and not saviors who need its followership. She is offering what market worlders so adore, a solution. The solution is to return, against their instincts, and even perhaps against their interests, to politics as the place we go to shape the world. If Cordelli is right, the basic assumptions of market world are wrong. Doing what good you can loses some of its luster in her mode of calculation. in which what you accept matters as much as what you do. Businesspersons calling themselves leaders and naming themselves solvers of the most intractable social problems represent a worrisome way of erasing their role in causing them. Seen through Cordelli's lens, it is indeed strange that the people with the most to lose from social reform are so often placed on the board of it. And Market World's private world-changing, for all the good it does, is also, for Cordelli, marred by its own narcissism. "It seems to me that these days everyone wants to change the world by themselves," she said. "It's about them, it's about what they do. But there are other people around you, and you owe it to them to support institutions that can, in the name of everyone, including in their own name, secure certain conditions for a more decent life. When a society helps people through its shared democratic institutions, it does so on behalf of all, and in a context of equality. Those institutions, representing those free and equal citizens, are making a collective choice of whom to help and how. Those who receive help are not only objects of the transaction, but also subjects of it, citizens with agency. When help is moved into the private sphere, no matter how efficient we are told it is, the context of the helping is a relationship of inequality, the giver and the taker, the helper and the helped, the donor and the recipient. When a society solves a problem politically and systemically, it is expressing the sense of the whole. It is speaking on behalf of every citizen. It is saying what it believes through what it does. Cordelli argues that this right to speak for others is simply illegitimate when exercised by a powerful private citizen. "You are an individual," she said. "You can't speak in their name. I can maybe speak in the name of my child, but other people are not your children." This is what it means to be free and equal and independent individuals, and, for better or for worse, share common institutions, she said. "Our political institutions, our laws, our courts, our elected officials, our agencies, our rights, our police, our constitutions, our regulations, our taxes, our shared infrastructure. The million little pieces that uphold our civilization and that we own together. Only these," Cordelli said, "can act and speak on behalf of everyone." She admitted, "They often don't do that, but that isn't the way out that Market World so often made it out to be." "It's our job," Cordelli said, "to make them do that, rather than working to weaken and destroy those institutions by thinking that we can effectuate change by ourselves. Let's start working to create the conditions to make those institutions better." Acknowledgements. In the summer of 2015, I stood anxiously at a podium in Aspen, Colorado, wondering what happens when you tell a room full of rich and powerful people that they are not the saviors they think they are. 4 years earlier, I had been named a Henry Crown Fellow of the Aspen Institute. You may recall it from these pages as the program that seeks to deploy a new breed of leaders against the world's most intractable problems. I was a strange pick. The fellowship says of its prospective leaders that all are proven entrepreneurs, mostly from the world of business. I was not, nor have I ever been, an entrepreneur. And writing, if it is a business, isn't a very good one. But I don't make a habit of turning down trips to Aspen, and the fellowship sounded pleasant. 4 one-week sessions with a group of 20 or so classmates, spread over 2 years, in which we would read important texts and debate them and discuss our lives and woes in secrecy while pondering how to make a difference. At first, my experience of the fellowship was defined by this small group. I bonded with my classmates and exchanged my struggles with theirs and ended up being the officiant at one of their weddings. As I nestled into the Aspen Institute's universe, there were other, more dubious pleasures. I began to have friends with private jets. Sometimes I flew in them. I mingled with the ultra-rich in antler-decorated mansions overlooking the roaring Fork Valley. I brought my mother to the Aspen Ideas Festival, where we shared a hotel room, and could not stop laughing about who would get the tiger-print bathrobe and who the leopard-themed one. Even as I savored these luxuries and connections, I found something amiss about the Aspen Institute. Here were all these rich and powerful people coming together and speaking about giving back, and yet the people who seemed to reap most of the benefits of this coming together were the helpers, not the helped. I began to wonder what was actually going on when the most fortunate don't merely seek to make a difference, but also effectively claim ownership of changing the world. It was peculiar that many of our conversations at the Aspen Institute about democracy and the good society occurred in the Koch building, named after a family that had done so much to undermine democracy and the efforts of ordinary people to change the world. It was off-putting when the organizers of our fellowship reunion sprang a Goldman Sachs-sponsored lunch on us, in which the company's do-gooding was trumpeted and its role in causing the financial crisis went unexamined. It bothered me that the fellowship asked fellows to do virtuous side projects instead of doing their day jobs more honorably. The Institute brought together people from powerful institutions like Facebook, the hedge fund Bridgewater Associates, and PepsiCo. Instead of asking them to make their firms less monopolistic, greedy, or harmful to children, it urged them to create side hustles to change the world. I began to feel like a casual participant in, and timid accomplice to, as well as a cowardly beneficiary of, a giant, sweet-lipped lie. Who exactly were we leaders of? What had given us the right to solve the world's problems as we saw fit? What interests and blind spots were we bringing to that problem-solving, given the criteria by which we had been selected? Why were we coming to Aspen? To change the system, or to be changed by it? To speak truth to power, like the writers we read in our seminars, or to help to make an unjust, unpalatable system go down a little more easily? Could the intractable problems we proposed to solve be solved in the way that we silently insisted, at minimal cost to elites, with minimal redistribution of power? In my fifth year in the program, I was asked to give a talk to a few hundred of my fellow fellows at our summer reunion. This wasn't unusual. A mantra of the fellowship is to learn from one another, rather than fly in outside speakers. At a given reunion, dozens of the fellows will speak in one way or another. As summer dawned and the gathering approached, the complicated feelings of the last few years swirled within me. My guilt and discomfort churned, until, at last, half certain, I decided to write and deliver the speech that was the seed of this book. "I want to suggest," I said that day from the podium, "that we may not always be the leaders we think we are." I described what I called the Aspen Consensus. The winners of our age must be challenged to do more good, but never, ever tell them to do less harm. Public speaking doesn't usually scare me, but that day it did. I didn't know what happens when you tell a group of people who consider themselves your friends that they are living a lie. But there I was. I finished the speech. People stood and roared, to my enduring surprise. Soon afterward, though, Madeleine Albright, the former U.S. Secretary of State, came on stage and gently disparaged my speech. "Qué cojones," another woman whispered to me. Her husband, though, started speaking ill of me behind my back. A billionaire came up and thanked me for voicing what has been the struggle of her life. Some in the leadership of the Aspen Institute began frantically asking who had allowed this outrage to occur. That evening at the bar, some cheered me, others glared at me icily, and a private equity man told me I was an asshole. Later that evening, beside a fireplace, David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, asked if he could write about my talk. I hadn't planned for my words to leave the room, but I agreed. He wrote his column. People began demanding to see the speech. I posted it online. It stirred many pots and conversations. I hadn't planned to write a book on this topic, but the topic chose me. Thus I spent the next 2 years talking to and writing about people living this paradox of elite change-making that somehow seems to keep things the same. I tell you this so that you know the book's origins, and so that I can give my first thanks to the Aspen Institute for embracing me and pulling back the curtain on elite-led social change. And I tell it because this backstory makes the following acknowledgement as plain as it deserves to be. The best way to know about a problem is to be part of it. This book is the work of a critic, but it is also the work of an insider-outsider to that which it takes on. There is almost no problem probed in this book, no myth, no cloud of self-serving justification, that I haven't found a way of being part of, whether because of naivete, cynicism, rationalization, ignorance, or the necessity to make a living. I chose not to write about these things in a personal way because I didn't want the book to be about me. But let me say here, while I am doing some acknowledging, that I once worked as an analyst at McKinsey, that I have given not one, but two TED Talks, that I earn a chunk of my income giving speeches, that I was attending conferences claiming to change the world long before I came to see them as a charade. I have tried to navigate my life honestly and ethically, but I cannot separate myself from what I criticize. This is a critique of a system of which I am absolutely, undeniably, a part. For a long time, as I wrote this book, I grappled with the strangeness of indicting the practices and beliefs of a group of people among whom I have many friends. I felt an instantaneous recognition when I came upon an old phrase from the poet Czesław Miłosz. In 1953, he published a book called The Captive Mind, about his dismay at so many of his fellow Polish thinkers succumbing, one rationalization, an excuse at a time, to the hypocrisies and repressions of Stalinism. He described his book as a debate with those of my friends who were yielding, little by little, to the magic influence of the new faith. That helped me greatly. For my book, too, is, among other things, a debate with my friends. It is a letter written with love and concern to people whom I see yielding to a new faith, many of whom I know to be decent. Of course, it is also a letter to the public, urging them to reclaim world-changing from those who have co-opted it. Because it is a debate with my friends, some of those I have written about are, unusually for me, people I knew socially before entering into the relationship of journalist and subject. Sean Hinton, Amy Cuddy, Sonal Shah, Andrew Kosoy, Laurie Tisch. I am grateful that they were willing to wrestle with these issues with me, even though my views were clear to them. I am no less grateful to all those other subjects whom I did not know, but who answered my emails and calls anyway, and took me up on sharing their stories and beliefs about making change. In a small handful of cases, I have changed names to protect privacy. I am indebted to two professors. As I read Thomas Piketty's masterpiece, Capital in the 21st Century, I came upon a line that brought the purpose of my own book into focus. Whether such extreme inequality is or is not sustainable, Piketty writes, depends not only on the effectiveness of the repressive apparatus, but also, and perhaps primarily, on the effectiveness of the apparatus of justification. That day, I decided my book would be an inquiry into the apparatus of justification. And Michael Sandel, who taught me at Harvard, was perhaps the first to plant in me the thought that money had transcended being currency to become our very culture, conquering our imaginations and infiltrating domains that had nothing to do with it. I want to salute those generous people who gave of their time to read chapters or even the whole manuscript. Richard Sherwin, Nicholas Negroponte, Joshua Cooper Ramo, Rukmini Girdardas, Tom Ferguson, Hilary Cohen, and Casey Gerald. Thanks, too, to Zachary Canapari for lending me his cabin in the woods. Then there is my heroic wife, Priya Parker. She is the first to know how the writing is going, because after all these years, she still insists on hearing every day's harvest out loud. My wise and ever-supportive parents, Shyam and Nandini, and a flotilla of friends too numerous to name, helped in their own vital ways, lending advice, shoulders, and diversions when the writing grew hard, as it always does, and providing rapid text message title feedback. And once again, I was blessed with the talents of Vrinda Kondalak, a masterful editor and a brilliant, effervescent friend, who sat beside me and went through the manuscript paragraph by paragraph for most of 2 weeks. My wonderful agent, Lynn Nesbitt, is one of those rare people who deserve their legendary status. There is no one better at shepherding books into the world than at dealing with all the obstacles that come in their way. There is no one more reassuring to a writer, no one better at taking the long view. And if there are still a few who, like Lynn, use their phones to gab and not just type, no one gabs better. Lynn led me to Alfred A. Knopf, but it was also a kind of homecoming. I first met my editor on this book, Jonathan Siegel, a decade or so ago, when I was writing about India. He didn't end up acquiring that book, but he profoundly shaped it, simply through his comments on the proposal. We found each other again with Winners Take All. John is smart, dedicated, passionate about books, and hard to please. When putting his penciled edits into the computer, I had the feeling of watching a master surgeon. At first, your eye focuses on the cutting, but then you notice the body he is bringing to health by removing what must be removed, and transplanting, and injecting, and suturing. This book wouldn't exist without his eyes, hands, and faith. I am also grateful to Knopf's brave leader, Sunny Mehta, for his championing of books, and to Jessica Purcell, Paul Bogards, Sam Aber, Julia Ringo, Kim Thornton Ingenito, and the rest of the team. This book is dedicated to my children, Orion and Zora, and to yours, who deserve the new age that is coming. This is Anand Girdardas. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. This program was directed by Brent Katz, executive producer Juliana Wilson. Text copyright 2018 by Anand Girdardas. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.